people have powerful feelings about the traffic in Los Angeles, it says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want to just go all the way to the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home, across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you can even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go down Fares, another tier, and in about 5 minutes, we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
Not so nice, the I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line, there's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast the tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard. Too Many People could also be a motto for its casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with freeways, with people, or his native L.A. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The 605, the 101, the 101, the 101, the I-10, the 210, the 605, the 101, the 405, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light.
Welcome to a very special episode of Los Angeles Nista. I'm your host, Edward Solis. And today, my in-studio guest is none other than Legs McNeil. to me, I'm actually speechless just growing up and having punk rock and music being a huge part of my life. I used to read and buy a punk magazine back at Middle Earth Records in Downey, California, and just, you know, collected as many as possible. And that was like my Bible. After I was going through my Kiss phase and had enough 16 magazines, I moved on to punk rock and discovered a lot of amazing bands. Legs, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for making it in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think it's really, interesting that you're out here. Well, obviously, you used to live out here in the past.
Yeah.
7 years you spent out here. You got a lot of, I'm not going to say a lot of irons in the fire. You got a lot of projects brewing and that will be coming out very soon. What I want to talk about is your affiliation with Punk Magazine before we get into all the new and upcoming stuff.
Sure. What do you want to know?
I think a lot of people that don't know the story should be filled in. I mean, can you just describe how it all got started?
John Holmstrom, who was a friend of mine from Cheshire, Connecticut, where I'm from, wanted to start a magazine about comics and rock and roll. That was his two big ideas. And I thought it was stupid.
Did you tell him that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I said, you know, and he wanted to call it Teenage News, which I didn't know was from an unreleased New York Dolls album. But John really was the guy who was going out and finding all the great music, you know, the Stooges, the Velvets, you know, the Dolls, you know. So, and half the stuff he put on, we'd say, take that off. That's crap. But we were in Cheshire during the, you know, we'd come home for the summer and, you know, try to go to parties and drink beer and get girls and things like that. And John came up and he took the train into, from New Haven, and we were at the guy who became our future publisher, Jed Dunn's apartment in the center of town, and we were listening to Blood on the Tracks by Bob Dylan, great album.
Gotcha.
And John came in and took the Dylan record off and put on The Dictators Go Girl Crazy, and then suddenly I could see what he was talking about, because that album was so much fun. Cars, girls, surfing, beer, nothing else matters here.
Yeah, there's an element of fun in it.
Yes, so much fun. And yeah, finally somebody was singing about our lives.
So you guys instantly connected to it because you guys were finding girls and beer.
Yes, or trying to.
Yeah,
trying to find beer.
So
well, we were getting the beer, but not many girls.
So there's instantly a commonality, a thread that tied you guys together.
Well, there was also a picture of them at a white castle in black leather jackets sitting around you know, a booth. And it was very cool. It was very like, oh, wow, this is, you know, because we were tired of, the hippie thing had become so depleted and so devalued, you know. It had become just another way to sell.
Now, let me ask you a question. Devalued because everyone was doing it? So it was just too much happening?
No, because it was turned into an advertising slogan and a marketing scheme, you know?
The hippie surfaced.
You know, freshen your teeth and whiten your breath with, you know, close-up, you know?
Gotcha.
That kind of thing. I forget the I usually remember them off the top of my head.
Oh, all the ads?
Yeah.
All the text copy.
Yeah.
So anyways.
I mean, we had those contact day glow flower, not day glow, but sunflowers on our kitchen table, you know, instead of getting a new one, you know, put contact down.
So
you pick at it instead of eating your beans. You know?
So all that was happening. So the Dictators was a breath of fresh air for you guys.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And that was like a shot of life, right?
Well, they kind of showed us how it could be, you know,
like a new model.
Yeah, how to be, you know? It was quite extraordinary. Because everyone else had been singing, you know, I've been to the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain.
And then the next band pretty much said the same thing, but in different words.
Yes, you know, it was just kind of like, oh, please, come on, you know.
Yeah.
And then here was this band. So We were driving back to New York. We were in the, Jed Dunn had the station wagon, and John said, he brought up this magazine again and said, I want to do this magazine. And we had been listening to The Dictators, and he said, I want to call it Teenage News. And I said, that's stupid. And he said, well, what should we call it? I said, why don't we call it punk?
And that's how the idea was born, well, for the name.
Yeah, and the next thing we did was go to this Bowery bar. That John had already gone seen this band called the Ramones once, and I had never seen them. And there was about 10, 15 people in CBGB's. And one of them was Lou Reed, who John was always playing. And he was always playing Metal Machine music, you know, that horrible album of feedback, saying, this is the future of rock and roll.
What year was this?
1975.
Oh, okay. So the first record was even out yet?
No,
76 was the first record.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we did the cover.
Right.
You know,
right.
We that was for the first Ramones album cover was a punk magazine photo shoot. They had spent all their money on with some photographer doing kind of a Beatles ripoff, and it didn't work out. And then they needed, and that was actually Roberta Bailey's first roll of film that she ever shot, you know. And it's now listed on the, I think it's in the top 20 or the top 10 of the best album covers of all time.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
But me and John and Arturo Vega were art directing it. I was telling Joey to scrunch down and Tommy to stand on his tiptoes, as you can see in that album, you know.
Right. You see him pointing up like that. Yeah. And do you remember clearly the first time you saw the Ramones?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, now was
how
that,
could you forget?
Yeah.
You
I
know?
Mean, was that a, that was another, it was, I mean, shot of life, just like when you discovered the Dictators.
Well, it's funny that we came up with punk before we didn't even know that there was this underground scene at CBGB's at all, you know. In fact, I went back the next night and saw the Talking Heads, and I thought, my God, this is great
stuff.
You
just immersed yourself immediately.
Oh, yeah.
In that CBGB's.
Yeah. And then the Ramones were, I mean, them walking out on the stage in black leather jackets, they looked like the SS had just come in, and they were not happy campers. They were like, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know. But actually, they started, when we saw them that first night, they started playing a different song. Dee Dee and Johnny started playing different songs. And they threw down their, and it, you know, this huge wall of noise came out.
Yeah, they always play, I think they always outdid everyone in amplification, the stacks.
Yeah.
Full volume.
But they threw down their guitars in disgust and walked off the stage. This was still a very early show where they were still having fights, you know, with each other.
During set time.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then they came back like 2 or 4 minutes later and went into Blitzkrieg Bop. And it was kind of like, this is great.
Right. You know? I mean, those imperfections are what really, I think, appealed to a lot of people. Connected with that. And I think,
well, it's all about imperfection, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And everywhere, every part of life, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, a funny story. I actually had a conversation with Greg Ginn, and I asked him, you know, what was one of the most important bands that you saw that you think was a catalyst for Black Flag? And he says, when the first time the Ramones came to LA at the Roxy, 76, I believe. And he said, yeah, I'd never seen anyone play as fast as him and as loud. And he took that ideal and just applied it to Black Flag immediately after. I think a lot of other bands all the way down the food chain could have a story how the Ramones, I mean, obviously we know that they're a huge catalyst for music, all, you know, all genres, guitar driven, hard rock, punk, metal, et cetera.
Well, Daniel Ray said something great in one of the documentaries. He said, you know, I listened to the Ramones and I laughed, but they immediately made 2/3 of my record collection obsolete, you know. And I always thought that was the Ramones advanced us, so all of us, so into the future that it's remarkable
that
one band came along. And
I think what it is they provided a building block for rock, metal, and punk. It's like, here's a foundation, you build off that.
Yeah.
And I think no one, even knew that existed, but they created that building block, and all these bands have built off it, and fast forward to present day. So anyways, since we're on that subject, I mean, you've been affiliated with so many different, you know, different books that have been out in the marketplace, like I Slept with Joey Ramone.
Uh-huh.
And as far as the Please Kill Me book.
Yeah.
Yeah. My question to you is, looking back at Punk Magazine, how many issues did you do?
17 or 18, I believe.
And one thing I don't remember, was it monthly or bi-monthly?
It was supposed to be monthly. It was monthly in the beginning when we were...
Did you guys make the deadlines?
Yes, we did in the beginning, yeah. But then John and Jed had a falling out, and Jed was fired, and John took over, and John's not the best businessman.
Do you think that, obviously, I mean, you know, as far as the actual work behind a monthly publication or bi-monthly publication and a book, is it a lot more pressure to work on a timeline?
Oh, yeah,
because you have to get the issue out versus a book.
To have a monthly issue, yeah. Oh, you're just watching the clock.
You're
all
just crammed,
the time.
Right?
Well, you're saying, like, okay, I have 2 hours off tonight, and you know, what am I going to do? And I'm going to call some girl and have her come over, you know. But then I have to get rid of her because I have to go back. You know,
you have to get the issue. Yeah,
and it's just, you know. I mean, at Spin, I was just, right. You know, I was there like 7 days a week.
Right now, yeah. I mean.
So was everyone else, too. You
know? I mean, especially in the editorial and a senior editor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, now, what timeline was that from what year to what year?
Let me see. Punk was from 75 to 80, I think. And Spin was from 82 to 90, 91, about there. And then Please Kill Me was 91 to 96.
Now, let me ask you something about the Spin days. Did you see from your first day to your last day there, the way, I mean, that's when the music industry had a lot more money available to promote records, to get people on board to, come check out a new artist that they're trying to break. Well, I think 91, 92, I mean, Nirvana was already out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So... Would you say when that record dropped, Nevermind, was that probably the most impactful record of your tenure at Spin that you saw come out? And
I don't think any records were impactful at Spin for me, you know, because in the 80s, rock and roll became so bad. I mean, it was also the time in order for you to sell the cover of the, you know, to sell the issue, you had to either put on Sting, Madonna, Bon Jovi, or someone else of that count. I mean,
you too.
But yeah, exactly.
To sell magazines,
yeah,
right?
And you know, so it was really depressing. So it was kind of like, you know, it was like putting out porn, basically. You know,
just churning out.
Yeah, you know. And so I always wanted to write the non-music features because I was more interested in stuff that was going on than I was with the music stuff.
So what was some of the editorial you were actually covering on the Spin days, and if it was a non-music material?
I covered the war in El Salvador. I covered the war in Belfast. Covered crack in the sticks. Stuff like that, you know.
Really diving into the relevant...
Just to keep me from writing music stuff, basically.
So crack in the sticks.
Okay, I'll go to the war.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as I don't have to
sticks.
Write about Gene Loves Jezebel, you know?
Right. That was the compromise. I'll write about meth,
yes,
and the sticks versus Gene Loves Jezebel,
yes, exactly,
or Air Supply. Yeah, just kidding. Yeah. Now,
was Air Supply even around in that?
I don't know. I'm just using that. I'm just trying to be funny. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we laughed, so I think we got something out of it. Okay, so you're in Los Angeles now, obviously. Let's tell everyone. What
am I?
You know what? I think we're in the Twilight Zone, actually.
Willoughby. Station stop is Willoughby.
Tell me about your speaking engagements you got coming up this weekend. You'll be at the Last Bookstore.
Yes, on Sunday, the Last Book. But
yeah.
Friday we'll be at, where is it, La Cita? La Cita on Friday. Then we'll be in Orange County on Saturday.
At TKO Records.
TKO Records.
Yeah. Mark Rainey, amazing guy.
Yeah, I hear Mark's a really good guy.
Yeah, TKO Records store. He has a label called TKO. They're great.
Yeah.
They've put out some Poison Idea reissues. He has a great store. You know, he's going against the grain, keeping independent store model alive. There's a lot of stores, you know, that are popping up. And I think guys like Mark, you know, is keeping that model alive as far as vinyl and record stores coming and buy records. So he works really hard to be proactive and enthusiastic. So I think that'll be a good situation for you out there as well. So let's tell everyone what you're going to be talking about as far as your engagements.
Well, I have the headphones on. Oh, I'm DJing on Tuesday. Where? Harvard and Stone? Harvard, wherever
that's
that
on
is.
Hollywood Boulevard.
Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, that's East Hollywood.
East Hollywood.
Yeah, Thai Town. Exactly. Yeah.
At 11 o'clock,
yeah,
I think.
Did you even know we have a subway
Yes, I did,
there?
Actually. I
okay, because a lot of people don't even know that.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I take a bus.
Do you? Perfect. Perfect. Well, a lot of our listeners, what they could do is actually take the Red Line, and if they want to go see Legs McNeil at the Harvard and Stone function, they could actually take the Red Line, get off Hollywood and Western, and walk east on Western, two blocks. So that's a pretty easy and green way to get there. So they could drink and not drive. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So,
what am I doing here? Basically, I just finished a new book. Mm-hmm. I started it last March. I just got out of a rehab for trauma, and my trauma therapist said, "Go home and write this." So I did. So we only had about a month off in the last year. We did a tour of the Midwest in the fall, and then we just did a winter tour of the South, which was fun.
Oh, very nice. And
so basically, I wanted to get out of the house because I just finished this book. My agent said, you know, it's going to sale. So I didn't want. I've been in the house alone, so you know, I wanted to get out
and connect with the people, right?
Well,
or maybe not connect, just get out.
Yeah.
Let me ask.
I haven't been connecting too well, have I?
No.
Is that truth?
Yes.
Is that truth? Is it an LA thing versus East Coast thing?
I don't know.
What do you think it is? Well, I have a question for you. I'm amazed at the fact that, I mean, you know, when I think of, you know, the East Coast, you know, hierarchy of music, you know, your name comes up. And
really? But I was never in a band.
It's okay.
I was just a fan.
People,
you know?
You're a fan that put words in print before the internet, before everyone thought they were a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's so much respect to you for that. And I think that those pre-internet days when you saw stuff in print, it was a lot more, carried a lot more weight.
Uh-huh.
And you used to live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. 7 years you spent here.
Yes. I was researching the porn book. I lived in Valley Village.
Right. And that's the valley is where it all goes down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was it culture shock for you out here, being an East Coast guy? Did you adapt easily?
There was just so much crap going on in New York, and I was just kind of fed up with it.
So must have felt good to get out.
It was the insanity of when Please Kill Me came out, and then I did a book for Pepsi Cola. They paid me tons and tons of money, and the book never came out.
Good for you. And you still got the money.
Yeah. But it was kind of like, excuse me.
No problem.
I don't know. It was just like, I want to get out and do something I want to do. I don't want to worry about my career, you know? And also, we had the movie, the Please Kill Me movie. We were under contract with Jersey Universal for 10 years, I think. And so I wanted to do the porn book. So I just came out and got a big house and a pool and a hot tub.
And the
weather was nice. Yeah, and the weather was
in the valley.
Yeah.
So did you have time while you're out here researching, excuse me, to immerse yourself in what was happening in music in Los Angeles?
No, I don't ever immerse myself into music.
So, as far as your tenure here in Los Angeles, you weren't really out here to see bands or anything. You were really just researching the porn industry, what you're here to do, and
yeah, keep my head down and you know, be quiet.
In the big house with the pool and the,
yeah,
the hot tub.
Yeah.
So, when we had the Northridge earthquake, were you out here?
No, I think I came just after.
Wow, yeah, because I think that's the same timeline.
It was really, 97 or 98 yeah, when I moved out here, yeah.
What was the catalyst to put you in that world to do the porn book?
What was the catalyst?
Yeah.
Well, they made it here, so, you know, I wanted to hang out and interview everyone.
Well, no, I mean, what did it for you? I mean, did somebody come to you, or did you just come up with that idea?
No, I had been involved in this huge sexual harassment suit at Spin. And neither side either called me to testify. And, but they were bandying my name around a lot. When Please Kill Me first came out in 1996, and my agent was ecstatic because she thought, oh, you're going to be, you'll be on Court TV and they'll be mentioning you every day and the book will sell. I was like, oh God. Anyway, I was just furious. And I thought, you know, rock and roll is a blues euphemism for, you know, having sex, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, we should be talking about sex. And so that's kind of where that was kind of the catalyst. And I thought, you know.
So you went way back to the original idea of where rock came from, and that came up.
Yeah, yeah. You know, unfortunately, I don't think the book held up in the end, but there were other problems. It was called The Other Hollywood, The Uncensored Oral History of the Porn Film Industry.
Did you go onto sets a lot and see, you know, for different production companies?
Yeah, my friends would, when people would always come from out of town and they'd go, oh, bring us to a porn set and I'd, mm-hmm. you know, arrange it. And mm-hmm. they'd always want to leave after they first got there because I remember there was this beautiful woman and she was having sex with a dildo. Can I say dildo?
Yeah, there's nothing censored here.
And she was she was fucking this other girl with a dildo. I walked in with these friends from out of town, and she was like, "Hey, Legs, how are you?"
Right.
That was. Yeah, and they were all like, they were all red faced, and you know,
yeah, like it was super uptight, right?
Yeah, you know, wow. It was kind of like, well, why do you want to go to a porn set if you're just going to get embarrassed? You know, I don't think they thought that people would actually be having sex on them. I don't know what they were thinking would have happened, but.
Yeah,
but I knew a lot of people from the porn industry in New York, and I had worked on a porn film
mm-hmm.
in 1974. It was called Blow Dry, Shampoo Teases, Blow Dry Pleases, and I was the assistant director. And I had wondered what had happened. And in retrospect, the modern porn industry was really born in 1972 with Deep Throat, and so I was there in New York very early on. And I wondered what had happened to these people and what was that scene was like. And it seemed very comparable to me to Please Kill Me and the punk scene. So I moved out here and started investigating.
When you say comparable, you think they're pretty linear, the punk scene and the porn?
They were happening, you know, almost simultaneously. You know, porn
and
was
in
a
the
little
70s.
Yeah, porn was a little earlier.
Right.
You know. So,
but same, in a way, same ideals, you know, you're going against the grain.
Yeah.
That,
yeah,
you know, yeah. The work ethic behind it, you do it yourself kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was all those ideas.
Although they were making more money because they were being financed by the mob early on. So,
sure.
You know, they had deeper pockets than the punk scene.
So as far as, the porn industry goes, I mean, it seems like it's pretty much dead because of the internet. And I think that, for the most part, the music industry, the mainstream music industry and the porn industry have that in common because, you know, there's hard copy discs are not really in demand no more. People are just becoming spoiled with certain analogies and, you know, ideals for on-demand video, which coincides for adult and mainstream movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that things change pretty quickly. Do you have any interest in doing a follow-up at all in the porn industry? Because you seem like you were...
No, but I would like to re-edit the book. I was
do a re-release?
Yeah, because I was signed with Judith Reagan. And I, when I handed the book in 2004, and I was late too, And they had signed Jenna Jameson in the meantime, and she did How to Make Love Like a Porn Star, which I knew there was going to be a big porn book, but my personal life, some stuff, some bad stuff happened, and I didn't know if I'd ever finish the book. So, and I called Judith, and I said, this is really two books, and she just started screaming at me. So it was just like, okay. So I did the best job I could, put it out.
Right. We're going to take a break.
Okay.
We're going to come back. We're going to play a new band by Greg Ginn called Good For You. We'll be back with Legs McNeil. Thank you.
I will be with you, and I know else. yourself.
Eddie Solis from Los Angeles, Nista. In studio guest, Legs McNeil. Legs, how are you?
Hi.
Hey. For those of you just joining the show, we got Legs in L.A. He's going to be out and about through Los Angeles for the weekend. Tomorrow, he'll be at La Cita at 8 p.m. And April 13th, he's going to be at TKO Records in Orange County for all you lazy people that don't want to come to L.A. They can just stay in their neighborhood. You know what I mean? And feel safe because... I'm sure people don't want to leave the orange curtain. They want to stay behind it. And then you're going to be doing a reading at The Last Bookstore on April 14th in downtown Los Angeles, 8 p.m. That's a great store. I've been there. I shop a lot there. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. And April 15th on Monday, Legs will be doing a DJ set at the Harvard and Stone in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard.
What?
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
That's Tuesday night, right?
Oh, it says Monday the 15th.
Tommy screwed it up, I think.
It's fine. You know what? We'll...
It's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
The Harvard and Stone is Tuesday.
Tuesday night, April 16th, 11 p.m., Harvard and Stone, 5221 Hollywood Boulevard, L.A., 323-466-6063 if you have any questions. And you have a website, harvardandstone.com. Okay, Leg, so you just finished a book.
Yes.
Let's tell the people what it's called and how long you've been writing it for.
It's called Live Through This, a memoir of love, trauma, and the exquisite awfulness of life.
So you're just coming off freshly writing it. There's no release date yet.
I finished it last week, and right. I wanted to get out of the house, and I thought, what better way than to tour and, you know,
right. So
do some readings from it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean you're fresh off creating it, so you're going to be out there doing some readings from it.
Yeah.
And getting people informed and you know, able to connect, you know, get people connected to it so when it comes out, they know what they're in for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
What's the?
No, I'm just. No, it's more a distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just because I was. I've been alone for months now. You know, working 10, 12 hours a day.
So I mean, you worked on it about 11 months straight, right?
12 months. Yeah.
A year.
Yeah. It took almost exactly a year.
And as far as creating the content from it, I mean, what is it about? What can the reader expect?
It kind of wrote itself. In the year 2000, when I was living out here, Gillian McCain, my co-writer on Please Kill Me, and I did a mini book tour of the West Coast. And we went up the West Coast and we hit... a friend of mine, Eileen Polk, who had been a photographer, and she managed The Blessed in New York and went out with Dee Dee Ramone. And she was actually with Sid and Nancy, not Nancy, but Sid and Michelle Robinson. She was at the party that night that Sid died, and I was producing some segments for VH1 or something. And she was living in all places, Eugene, Oregon, and I flew her down and I did an on-camera interview with her and, you know, did the segment. And she said to me, "Legs, you know, when I get my photographs developed, will you and Jillian come do a reading from Please Kill Me?" I said, "Sure, no problem," because she hadn't gotten her photographs developed in 20 years, and, you know, I thought she would never.
So they were sitting there that long?
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't even see those photos yet?
No one.
Wow.
Did, you know. So she called me 3 months later and said, "Okay, I'm doing the photo show, and you have to do the reading, because you promised me." And I said, "Okay." And I called Jillian. And Jillian was really excited because she thought of all these great used bookstores on the West Coast that we could, you know, rape and plunder.
Infiltrate.
Yeah. So we kind of set up the tour ourselves as kind of a used book shopping tour, you know, to go to, you know, Eugene and Portland. And it ended in Seattle. And on the last night, and what was amazing about it was, you know, we were kind of doing our own stuff. And we really weren't following what was going on with Please Kill Me. But there were hundreds and hundreds of kids every night. It was bizarre, you know.
Wow.
Because I think... at the time, TV shows like The O.C. and The Gilmore Girls were using Please Kill Me to show when one of their characters was going to do something transgressive, like when one of the girls on The O.C. I didn't watch these shows, so I never saw the book on the show, but when one of the girls was going to have a bisexual experience, they showed her reading Please Kill Me in order to prepare the audience.
So that was like the setup, you know, for like something extreme.
Yes, exactly.
So they have Legs book in their hand. Yes. And like she's about to be with another girl and right. Do crazy stuff to her.
Yeah.
So, you got the Legs McNeil book in your hand.
So I think all the kids thought, oh, you know, here are these people who did the naughty book, and we're going to go see the authors of the naughty book. And, on the last night of the tour, we were in Seattle, and we were in the Capitol Hill section reading at, I forget what it's in the book. The guy's name was Tim Hayes, a really nice guy, owned a book and record store, and we did a reading there. And I met this girl, and she just knocked me out. Her name was Shannon, and I fell in love with her, and... the book is about my 5 month affair with her, and it flashbacks to the beginning of Punk Magazine, and to hanging out with Norman Mailer, and hanging out with William Burroughs and stuff like that, and Joey Ramone, and, you know, and kind of my life. And Shannon told me that she'd been a heroin dealer and a junkie, and I thought, you know, everyone I know is an ex-something, an ex-porn star.
Was she from Seattle?
She was from Seattle.
That was her hometown then?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she flew down, and actually we went on our first romantic picnic at Spahn Ranch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Charlie Manson's Spahn Ranch, which she loved. and I was working on the Wonderland Avenue Murders of the Porn book, so Eddie Nash had come up from trial, so we would go to the Eddie Nash trials and together, and she just loved all that, you know, murder, and we would go to where the Black Dahlia's body was found and things like that. And I thought, you know, I finally met the girl for me, you know.
Sure.
And as it turned out, she hadn't stopped using heroin, and she injected herself with black tar heroin infected with necrotizing fasciitis, which is flesh-eating bacteria. And her leg was amputated, and she didn't survive the operation. And it kind of sent me into a tailspin, of which I'm recently recovering from.
So it was...
She died.
She died, and yeah. It was just a lot of trauma for you.
Well, I had also had an extreme amount of trauma growing up that I never quite dealt with. I mean, I kind of put my whole childhood and, you know... in a little box in 1975 when I became Legs McNeil, and I didn't deal with any of it. And I really should have dealt with it after Shannon died, but I was just too much of a mess. And so I finally, and doing this book has been really helpful.
Has it been therapeutic for you?
It has, actually. And you know, that sounds so dumb. It sounds so like Oprah speak, therapeutic. Has it been therapeutic for you, Legs?
Legs, has it opened up your mind?
Yes, but it has, actually. I don't have the anxiety I had. I mean, well, I was just a mess. I should have really been institutionalized.
I mean, by
really early on.
Working on this, I'm sure it's been therapeutic, and it's put you in a better place mentally, right? I mean,
I mean, I've gone through some fundamental change, but I've yet to see what that is, you know? I've yet to, because I've just finished it. So I don't really know.
I mean, this new work is just fresh from being. I mean, you just finished it a few weeks ago.
No, a week ago.
Yeah, so I mean, it's as fresh as it gets. You're right out of the house.
Yes,
doing this and reliving all those moments, replaying all these experiences in your head with her. I mean, that must have been really rough going back.
It was really interesting because on April 4th or 5th. I had interviewed, we had driven across, she loved New York, and I had to be there for different things, and she would fly in to New York City, and we decided to drive across country once, and she had told me that she had sold heroin to Courtney and Kurt and Courtney in Seattle, and I thought, hey, can I interview you, you know? In case someone wants me to do a grunge article or, you know, something like that, just for deep background. So when we were driving cross country, I interviewed her, and I'd never listened to the tapes. I had them transcribed, and I used them to jog my memory. And there's a part in the book where I do interview her, and it was kind of shocking, really shocking, because she had... I had no moral dilemma with her being a heroin dealer, you know, but her friend who she used to buy from, I guess the Mexican mafia guys, murdered, and she took his job. And I had never dated anyone that I had a seriously moral dilemma with, you know, because in my world, you don't profit from murder. And she had, you know, she was a tough little cookie, you know. But she was a sweetheart. Even now, it's very, very hard for me to imagine her being a junkie, even though she died and my life was completely screwed up from it. It's very hard for me to imagine her a junkie because she had none of the signs. She had no track marks. She did not out. I mean, I think heroin really gave her a lot of energy, and she was always bubbly and giggly and laughing. And we were just, you know, every other girlfriend said, yeah, I'd be a great girlfriend too if I was stoned on heroin the whole time, you know. But, you know, I mean, we were really having fun, you know.
Going back and listening to those tapes for the first time, I mean, that's... Did you transcribe them in the past or did you break them out and transcribe them?
Well, I've since not... I don't do my own transcripts anymore. I didn't do them on Please Kill Me. We had three full-time transcribers.
So they were already archived?
Well, my assistant at the time transcribed them, but he was so grossed out by one part that he didn't put it in, and that was on April 4th or 5th. She had already had flesh-eating bacteria once in her life, and it was, and she describes it on this tape that was never transcribed that I listened to last week.
for the first time in my life. And I transcribed that myself, actually. It was just absolutely horrifying. Because they were, I mean, it was just, it was a nightmare.
Is that going to be in the book?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's already in.
Wow.
Yeah.
And as far as...
Sorry, I didn't mean to bring you down.
Oh, no. Oh, no. No, I'm just being open and wanting...
Well, the thing is, I thought if I'm going to write about Shannon so honestly, the real challenge for me was to say, can I write about myself as honestly as I'm writing about Shannon? And that was really...
Because there's a duality to it. You can't just be one-sided, right? Because she's there in your relationship with you.
Right. And I had... So it was kind of like... Come to Jesus time for me, you know?
You had to come out of your skin and really say,
hate writing about myself. I hate talking about myself. I'd rather be talking about you and asking you questions and you know, doing all that. But I really don't, I'm not comfortable. You know, I to do the legs persona is very easy, you know, but to write, when people want to know about the Ramones and Iggy and all that stuff, it's very easy to do, but to talk about
yourself and your work and your experiences, you don't find that as easy as talking about maybe Joey, Johnny, Dee Dee, and Tommy,
exactly.
Or whoever.
Exactly.
Well, Legs, thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you.
Very, very deep, sincere content in this book, and I'm very honored to have you here.
Oh, thanks.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day and stay in Los Angeles. For people wanting to connect with Legs McNeil, pleasekillme.com.
Okay.
For all your information. And tomorrow you will be at La Cita in downtown. And on Saturday you'll be in Orange County at TKO Records, 7 p.m. Our good friend Mark is going to be facilitating that. And Sunday the 14th, the last bookstore in downtown. That's a great place. I've seen KRS-One do something there. And Tuesday you'll be at the Harvard and Stone, the 16th of April at 11 p.m. doing a DJ set. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.